From the witch trials of the past to modern laws requiring the disclosure of haunted property, the justice system has crossed paths with the strange and supernatural for centuries. Brad Blair takes us down that road and reveals how lawmakers and courts have dealt with the uncanny around the globe. Legislation to provide legal protection for Bigfoot, demonic possession as a murder defense, jurors seeking evidence from a Ouija board, and much, much more. That's tonight, right here on the very best in paranormal programming. I'm Dave Schrader, and this is my Paranormal 60.
I'm not gonna stand here and listen to this baloney.
He won't float. He doesn't stand for baloney.
Sounds like a lot of supernatural baloney to me.
Supernatural, perhaps. Baloney, perhaps not.
Hello, my little darklings. Thank you so much for joining me here. Had another amazing weekend out at the Palmer House Hotel in Sauk Center, Minnesota. We will cover that and play some of the evidence and talk about some of the fun moments this Wednesday on the Paranormal 60 News. Joining me right now, I'm excited to have this guy with me. He has been an integral part of the Michigan Paracon since its inception, and he has co-authored other books. He is out with a brand new book called Paranormal Justice, Hauntings, Cryptids, and Curses in the Court of Law. Joining me here on the program, ladies and gentlemen, Mr. Brad Blair. Hello, Brad.
Hey, Dave. Thanks for having me on.
My pleasure, my friend. Thanks a lot for being here with us this evening. And the book just came out. You're doing great. I hear a lot of great things about it. I hope to get a chance to sit down and read it very soon myself, as soon as I'm not back to back to back on the road. But I got to know a little bit about this. What encouraged you to, or inspired you perhaps is the best word, to look at the legal versions of the supernatural?
Yeah, it actually goes back. I can trace this back to 1991. Sitting in my parents' living room, it was the TV on in the background just for kind of background noise with the news going. And I heard this story come across about a house being declared legally haunted. Legally haunted. And this was a case out of the state of New York that had went to the New York Supreme Court, Stambofsky versus Ackley, which has become quite the famous case throughout the years. And I thought, wow, how could some place be legally haunted? I mean, the law system really doesn't acknowledge the paranormal for the most part.
Right.
And that kind of stuck with me over the years. And I started looking a little more and more. And of course, back then, the interweb was in its infancy. So it wasn't quite so easy to just sit down and pull up cases. And it's still not, which I found while doing research on this book. But it always stuck with me, you know. And I'd come across some books on law enforcement's dealings with the paranormal over the years, but I could never quite find that next step. And I thought, man, there's got to be more to this. So kind of led down that rabbit hole where over the years I started collecting some cases as I could find them. And then really during COVID, when I was stuck in the house like everyone else, and said, maybe it's time to start putting this together and digging a little bit deeper and seeing. And I really didn't know if there would be enough material for a full book at that time. And as I got into it, not only did I dig up enough, I guess, to fill this book of 200 pages, I ended up editing quite a few stories out that would have been somewhat repetitive and some that just didn't quite fit. Maybe I could have squeezed them in here and there, but
right.
Yeah. So it was really that long in the building. So it was one of those things to keep from going insane during COVID. I sat in my office and just started compiling all of this and going through the notes and going down these different, like I said, rabbit holes on this. And it was interesting. Some of these stories I was coming up with, you'd find these big splashy headlines, you know, haunted house, people being sued, blah, blah, blah. And then you wouldn't see anything else. So the papers love to, and most media outlets, they'd get that initial shock value, but then they'd never follow up on where the case went. So that took some digging, and that took some logging into court records, spending a lot of time, a little bit of money to get access to some of these records, and just sorting through and seeing where this all went.
Yeah, it's really kind of amazing when you think about it. And I like your kind of inquisitive nature, because I remember hearing about that story too. And I think that is like the first and only officially registered haunted house in the United States, unless you know it's changed since then. But how do you go about proving a haunting exists? I mean, that means we have to prove the existence of ghosts to the court of law.
So Stambaugh versus Ackley, if you're not familiar with the case, and I ended up pulling up a whole section, ended up being a whole chapter on just real estate and stigmatized real estate and different such things. But with Stambaugh versus Ackley, it was one of those cases that the court wasn't necessarily saying that the house was definitely haunted. The way the case went was the Stambaugh family bought this home in the Hudson Valley of New York off the Ackleys, and they moved in. They bought it. They were getting ready to move in, and they started hearing all of these stories about the place being haunted. And all of these neighbors were coming around and saying, oh, well, you're buying the haunted house down on the waterfront. And they started looking into it more and more. And what came about in the actual court case was the Ackleys had been telling people for years that their house was haunted. They had their house appear on haunted tours. Mrs. Ackley, especially, she had names for the ghosts. She'd conversed with them throughout the years, and she was very much into the paranormal side of things. She even wrote an article with Reader's Digest, My Haunted House on the Hudson. So the courts came back and determined, and this kicked back through appeals up to the Supreme Court of the state of New York, which is when it was ruled on in 91, was that if you're out there telling everyone your house is haunted, and you've got articles out, and you've got walking tours coming by your house at Halloween that you're interacting with, then you obviously believe your house to be haunted, and you right. need to disclose that, because nobody can call in a home inspector to come and find out whether or not the house is haunted. You can do all of your due diligence without this coming up. So yeah, that was New York ended up being, I believe it's one of only four states that has anything to do with the paranormal on real estate doctrine. So it was interesting, and just the way that case unfolded and how it went through layer after layer after layer in the courts. And yeah, eventually the Ackleys had to return the down payment from what I understood, though, the house was sold shortly thereafter. So it was somebody that was more enthused with the ghost. So, you know, as well as I do, there's that market out there that there are people that are going to jump on a haunted house just as much as others would shy away. So, you know, walking downtown in the French Quarter in New Orleans, when you have apartments and houses for sale with big haunted or not haunted signs, lets you know there's a little bit of both markets out there.
It is. It's really kind of a compelling and telling sign, right? When people are influenced and interested by that. I wonder then if the flip side could be said. If I purchase a house that you are advertising as haunted, and in fact, there are no ghosts, do I get any kind of recourse for pulling out of the transaction or suing for not having the activity take place? I wonder if that's going to end up being something that we'll see unfold in the future.
That would be interesting to see how that was handled, because as I said, this was a case where the Ackleys were so public about their ghosts and their hauntings, but there was nothing in the real estate deal about it. Now, if you put it out there that it was haunted, yeah, you've got a whole other case going on there, I would think. I'm not sure how the courts would handle that. There was nothing along that lines in the research for this book that I found. Maybe the next one, we'll see.
That's what I said. It's going to be interesting as these things continue to unfold, because you've got places like the Conjuring House. And if it were right. to go up for sale, people are buying it with the idea that this house is a very famous haunted home, and buying it most likely for that reason. If they get it and nothing happens, where does that put you? You know, that's going to be a fascinating wave of the next future for real estate and stigmatized properties.
Well, and the Conjuring House makes an appearance in the book too briefly. The people that owned it sued Warner Brothers because people were starting to trample their lawn. They were all over the place. Once the movies really hit, and they claimed they didn't want anything to do with it, but there were some appearances that they made on different television shows as well too. So that ended up being settled out of court. Another one that was somewhat similar, The House from American Horror Story, that
oh,
first
right.
season, that sold to a doctor who he and his wife found they got a little bit more than they were bargaining for. Not only were there signs that the house was haunted, which wasn't a big factor in the real estate deal, but it was rabid fans from American Horror Story that were showing up, starting fires on their lawn and having religious ceremonies, trying to break into the house to the point that they had to stop living there. And that went on. They sued the real estate agent who they had purchased it from, as well as the people that they bought the house from. And it went through court for years. And they finally dismissed it with prejudice because it didn't seem to be going anywhere. And they were just paying more and more lawyer fees. But they made the argument that they had no idea that this house had the reputation that it did. This was well after American Horror Story had hit big. So it's kind of hard to believe on that. At least I have a hard time believing that you wouldn't know you were stepping into that kind of a house.
Especially because having done the paranormal news now for the last 17, 18 years, one of the big things that we always see is when a famous or notorious house goes for sale, because it's listed and it's picked up by news services around the world.
Yeah.
So I remember when that house went up for sale and it was being blasted in the media constantly. Mm-hmm. How do you not know that that's the house that you're going in to look at? I just, you know, in doing the basic due diligence for a home, when you see your house appearing on TV, that should have been a big clue.
Exactly. And there's numerous cases that ran right along that lines that I ran into. And you said some people didn't seem to mind too much. You get cases like you said, the Conjuring house, the Lizzie Borden house that sold mm-hmm. for an astronomical amount because it's a tourist attraction. So
right.
you have, on one hand, you have people that are buying up these properties to put a commercial value on them. The Conjuring House, they'd been, after that resold, they'd been leasing that out, last I knew, for ghost hunts and special events. And it's been popping up on various paranormal shows. But then you've got people that, yeah, I could see if you had, when you bought the place and it was not in the public spotlight, and then all of a sudden you've got a major motion picture out, there's a little bit more to it then, but I guess buyer beware is what a lot of that comes down to.
Well, and what you just heard, folks, is important because many of you have come to me as a member of the Holzer Files. Why didn't you guys attempt to get into the Amityville house? Because Amityville is very closed off. My understanding is when you purchase the house, you are not allowed to use it as a museum, a bed and breakfast, any type of tourist destination. Filming outside is not allowed. I don't think they can keep you from filming inside the house, but you could be on a soundstage anywhere saying you're inside the house without having any kind of referential point. But people are very, very irritable when you're out there. I know Jeff Belanger and I went out there to shoot a pilot in Long Island, and we had a break in filming. So we ran out to go see the Amityville house. And Brad, we weren't on that property more than 3 seconds, just standing there quick enough to take a picture. Cars are blowing by and honking their horn and cursing at us and yelling, "Get off, you're idiots, get out of there, rah, rah, rah." And you realize just how irritating that has to be for people that own these properties. But on the other side, if you buy the Amityville horror house, you're kind of asking.
Yeah, you're kind of getting what you're, yeah, and that the Amityville case pops up too, but not so much due to the house being haunted, but all of the legal actions that came afterwards with the Lutzes, with their publishers, the second Amityville movie that they'd planned on making got completely blown off, and they went a complete different direction. I mean, the Lutzes were plagued with lawsuits until the day they died from that house, from the books. There were a lot of claims of hoaxes, of course, that have been thrown out there. And for every person that claimed it was a hoax, somebody else was coming out and saying, "Oh no, we were there," or "We know the family." But they ended up being in just a plethora of lawsuits after they'd moved out of the house and gained the notoriety from the books and from the movies. So yeah, I mean, it's one of those kind of be careful what you wish for things. Once they had had the book out there, and of course that turned into the original Amityville horror movie, which turned into a slew of movies, and they tried to sue to stop people from using the Amityville name, which came down to the fact that it was just the name of the town, and they couldn't stop that in one of their lawsuits, but many that were associated with that. And it was almost a Amityville curse, I guess you could almost say, that followed the Lutzes till their deaths.
No doubt. And for people that are interested, there is a website called diedinhouse.com.
Yes,
diedinhouse.com. And you can actually go there, and I think for $12 or $13, purchase a full assessment and report on your home. And if they were able to uncover any deaths associated with the house, they will give you the abstracts to tell you who owned the property, what the names were, who was known to have died on property, who was known to die while they owned the house. So you do get that information. So if you are dealing with a haunting, you have perhaps some information to start with. You can also follow them on social media. They put up a lot of really fascinating posts, Died in House. And they'll put up pictures every day of a famous murder site or mystery site and give you a little bit of the background and history. And they always warn you, make sure you know what you're buying before you purchase it. And it's amazing to me how many houses have had murders in it that people have no idea that that took place in their home. And they weren't required by law to, mention that up front when it comes to stigmatized properties.
No, in fact, one case in California that I covered in the book, it was an elderly woman that she'd purchased a retirement home and moved into this neighborhood, and peaceful. She never reported a problem with the property, let's say. And then she got talking to one of the neighbors and they said, "Oh, you moved into the murder house down the road." Excuse me? Oh, yeah, this woman was fleeing her abusive husband with her kids, and the guy broke into the house and shot her, her kids, her parents. It was her parents' house at the time. He ended up in prison. Obviously, he got caught right away. But they covered this up. Nobody was talking about it. And when it ended up going to court, what really sunk the old owners, and they didn't make them take the property back, but they did make a difference. They had to refund a part of the money due to what the courts felt that dropped the property value, because they found out that their realtors had asked neighbors not to talk about what had happened there and withheld that. And the new homeowner claimed that after she found out about it, she was seeing handprints form on the wall. She was hearing somebody dragging themselves down the hallway. Now, none of this had happened before she found out. So it seemed like it was more of a psychological effect from finding out what had happened in the house versus what you and I would consider a legitimate haunting. So yeah, it was at a time that pre-internet, so it would not have been easy for the woman to go out to research this on her own. Her due diligence was done and nothing popped up for that.
Thesis himself from our chat room says, "You moved into a murder house" is the least welcoming expression to give a new neighbor.
Yeah, I would agree with that.
Yeah, terrifying, right? And you look at the concepts of what is law, and I know my wife does a true crime podcast, and a week or two ago, she did one on the Greenbrier ghost. She did one on the Red Barn ghost, kind of an interesting little set of stories where a ghost helps solve their own crime. Right. And it's interesting to consider that there have been these kind of gray areas in the law from time to time when it comes to elements of the supernatural. I mean, we went kind of from one extreme where, hey, I got to tell you, I didn't sell any merch at my table, and Brad Blair kept giving me dirty looks. I'm pretty sure he's a warlock or a witch. And that's all it took. And you were being pressed or hung or dipped in a lake. So we went from that far extreme of it didn't take much to get you facing the law to, you know, this end of the realm where now it's like you've got to prove it. And how do you go about proving some of these different elements?
Well, and some of the ones that you just mentioned, the Greenbrier ghost, and we're going back a couple centuries on those cases. And I do mention those. They're discussed in the book because they're very interesting in the way that the court handles those. But we can come up to the 1970s, the Teresa Bassa case, the ghosts there from Beyond the Grave murder case. She was murdered in her apartment, this woman. She was a hospital worker, murdered in her apartment in Chicago area. And they made it look, staged it to look like she was raped and murdered. Her body was stripped, clothes were thrown on her, and she was lit on fire. And this went on, the investigation went on for months, and they had no suspects, no clues. And all of a sudden, they got a call from this woman who lived a couple towns away saying that the ghost of this woman was appearing to that her mm-hmm. and telling her, this is who killed me. This is what happened. And by God, the police went and looked, and they found the dead woman's jewelry in this guy's apartment. And it turned out there was a connection. They'd worked together. And this guy had done some work for her at her home in the past and was supposed to have been there on the night of the murder. So this all, you know, without this woman's, she claimed, and there were books written after the fact, and she made some television appearances. So she gained some notoriety off of it. But there was no evidence. The police had no clues. The case was going cold before this self-proclaimed psychic woman came out and said, yeah, I've been visited by her ghost, and this is who did it. And as it turned out, the trial went kind of wonky. It looked like he might have gotten off. They were setting up a new trial, and he changed his plea to guilty. So he never said why. I couldn't find anything as far as if he ever gave a reason why he came out and admitted to it. But yeah, you know, strange things like that, they're still happening in modern days.
Right. I mean, there's been some really compelling stories surrounding reincarnation with children that have come forward to state. And I know there was a very famous case in India where a young boy was talking about a village that was hundreds of miles away. He had never visited. His family was way too poor to have ever visited, but he was able to detail the outlie of the area. He knew the people, he knew who he was. And it became a big enough story that they actually followed up, brought this kid to the town. Kid went right to his front door. I believe his ex-wife, his widow, was still living there. And he admitted that it was like his best friend that had murdered him. And when confronted with this, the best friend folded and admitted to everything. So, you know, it's, and that's contemporary. That's been like in the last 20, 30 years, I believe, that a story like this unfolds. So there's an interesting element of how the supernatural does play into it. Do you think, Brad, I mean, you've been researching and investigating the paranormal for a long time as well. Do you think in those instances, it's really a case of reincarnation? Or do you think that that kid was just given a gift and couldn't differentiate between the visions he was having about this, like a medium, and believing it was himself, you know, being able to disassociate that?
I had this same conversation on this same case with Chip Coffey. We were talking about it. Mm-hmm. Chip was pretty convinced that this was a case of reincarnation. I said, well, could it be possession? Could it be spirit possession by the dead man coming back and taking over this kid and bringing him over? I don't know. Nobody knows. It's bizarre. It was one of the more bizarre cases that I've ever read. I believe the boy was 3 years old. And started saying he wanted to go see his other family. And finally, his parents acquiesced. They took him, and he went right to the house. He knew everything about it, knew everything about the people living there. And there was no explanation whatsoever. So, yeah, these things, they're not back in the 1600s, 1700s days of witchcraft and werewolf trials. These are modern cases.
We need to take a quick break. Brad Blair is our guest this evening. His brand new book is out, Paranormal Justice, Hauntings, Cryptids, and Curses in the Court of Law. We have a link for that on today's program guide. So whether you're watching live or listening to the podcast, go check out the program guide, find that link, and go purchase a copy. And remember, when you buy the book, and if you like the book, remember to rate and review the book. Even if you didn't buy it off of Amazon, make sure that you rate it on Amazon, because the more ratings and reviews the authors get, the more their book is exposed to more readers just like you. We'll be back in a moment with more right here on the Paranormal 60. My favorite spring cleaning takeaway is the post-clean clarity that you get. That, wow. How have I been living like this feeling? It's kind of like when you find out that you've been paying a fortune for wireless when Mint Mobile has phone plans for just $15 a month when you purchase a 3-month plan. Wow, how have I been affording this? It's time to switch to Mint Mobile and get unlimited talk, text, and data for $15 a month. The quality that I've received from Mint Mobile is second to none, and I've tried them all. And this is an amazing company to work with that actually cares about their clients and the prices that they charge. So if you're on that fence wondering, should I make the shift? You're going to get great coverage, you're going to get great customer service, and all of the bells and whistles you expect from the bigger brand names. Say bye-bye to your overpriced wireless plans and their jaw-dropping monthly bills and unexpected overages. Mint Mobile is here to rescue you with premium wireless plans starting at just $15 a month. So to get this new customer offer and your new 3-month unlimited wireless plan for just $15 a month, go to mintmobile.com/P60. That's mintmobile.com/P60. Cut your wireless bill to $15 a month at mintmobile.com/P60. $45 upfront payment required, equivalent to just $15 a month. New customers on first 3-month plan only. Speeds slower above 40 gigabytes on unlimited plan. Additional taxes, fees, and restrictions apply. See Mint Mobile for details.
Are you troubled by strange noises in the middle of the night? Do you experience feelings of dread in your basement or attic? Have you or your family ever seen a spook, specter, or ghost? Then Haunted Magazine issue 41 might just be for you. In issue 41 we have The Enfield Haunting, an interview with Dave Schrader, Danny Robbins, and lots more. Out now in stores, app stores, and online at bit.ly/hauntedmagazine. Remember, don't be normal. Be paranormal.
We're back. Brad Blair, our guest. And if you would love the chance to meet Brad Blair and get signed copies of his book, I have it on good authority. He'll be out at the Michigan Paracon this year, taking place in August in Sault Ste. Marie, Michigan, and probably at many other places before then. But that is the big premier paranormal conference here in the United States everybody likes to go to.
Yeah, August 22nd through the 24th this year. Tickets available at miparacon.com. Meet the one and only Dave Schrader as well.
Is this the 14th year?
This is the 14th year. Should have been the 15th, but that little thing called COVID crept up and that was a tough call to make at the time because some places were opening up and it was about, I want to say 8 weeks out that we just said we can't do it. We had everyone booked. We had a lot of flights booked and it just wasn't going to work. It wouldn't have been safe. I don't think at the time we weren't quite far enough over that hump. So yeah, we ended up putting that off for a year. So this would have been our 15th. It will be the 14th. And as always, a huge lineup of paranormal presenters from reality television, authors, podcast hosts, you name it. We're still signing a few more, trying to get some things finalized. But miparacon.com, you can get all the info on that. Tickets. I believe Dave Schrader is doing a special workshop this year as well.
Yeah, I'm going to be doing one on spell casting. So if you want more information, go check out miparacon.com. Again, there's a link for it on today's program guide, so it's very easy to find. But come on out. I guarantee you will have a great time because for 14 years, I've been a part of this now, 13 of the 14 years. I think I missed the first year, and that was it. It has been one of the premier events. We always have a great time, an amazing collection of speakers, presenters. There is scaryoke. There is drinking. There is fun, frivolity. There is a lot of presentations and breakout workshops to help you no matter what angle of the paranormal you're fascinated with. There is somebody there that can talk to you and address these situations. And it's probably one of the most comprehensive and close events, meaning that most of the presenters are out walking around during the entire convention and afterwards, hanging out and, you know, having fun with all of the attendees. So it's a great opportunity to just come out and be a part of a giant family. So again, Michigan Paracon, miparacon.com. We're here with Brad. His new book is out, Paranormal Justice, Hauntings, Cryptids, and Curses in the Court of Law. I'd like to know a little bit about the curses angle. Is that something that, now again, to me, that seems like the 1600s, we would be dealing with people dealing with curses and witchcraft. How close to contemporary time do these cases actually start to bleed?
Oh, geez, some of the curses, 2-3 years old. They were some of the more recent that I found.
Really?
One case in England, a young lady was upset with her boyfriend leaving her, and she decided to do some spell work and send a severed pig's head to his workplace and fun things along that lines. And that
where exactly does one order a severed pig head to be delivered? Is that FTD?
I'm not sure where that's at on Amazon. I think they've got something for everyone on there. So
wow.
There's a specialty site for everything. But this,
yeah,
this was in England. And this was, I believe, around 2019, 2020. So, and she'd had some other issues in the past with trying to curse jilted lovers. So, yeah, no, I mean, this stuff's still going on nowadays. It's just interesting to see how the courts react and sometimes how the people react when they get in front of the court system.
How are they even getting that far along in the court system? I mean, I could understand to a degree, it seems like stalking practices and it's privacy invasion. But when the concept of curses comes in, does that element of the case get thrown out? And do they focus more on the strange and unusual behavior of the perpetrator?
A lot of it comes down to the intent. You know, what were they trying to force to happen? Obviously, there are some mental health issues that come into play here. And in a lot of these cases, too, it's some people that think they're supernatural creatures that are going out and causing things to happen. That comes in a lot. And you'll see the courts take that into account. But it's the intent. Is she trying to kill someone? What is she trying to cause to happen to the individual? And that's really kind of goes right back to most curses, most magic, witchcraft. You know, what is the intent that's being put out there? And if it's extremely negative, very malevolent, then the courts take that into account on most occasions.
On most occasions. Yeah, mm-hmm. Worthy of looking at. Brad, I was surprised to hear that, you know, I mean, obviously witchcraft trials seem to dry up, you know, pretty early on in the 1600s or late 1600s here in the United States. You know, but in other countries, they continued on for quite a bit longer. Some even, as I understand, in England, even during World War II, there was a woman that was tried and convicted of witchcraft and was actually put in jail for it. Do they continue on still? I know Papua New Guinea is big for witchcraft and witch trials and things that continue to this day. And they're very cautious with how they cross those swords because they're, my understanding, very superstitious of those threats.
So, South Africa, there are still witchcraft laws, at least the most recent I could find. They were still fighting to try and get these abolished. But the case you were talking about in World War II, I'm thinking is the Helen Duncan case in 1944. And she was convicted under the Witchcraft Act of 1735. What happened is she was having a seance and they busted in. She had accurately predicted or put out there a couple of fallen soldiers' names and some of the information from where they were in their missions. And what happened was some facets of the government authorities were worried that she was going to give away governmental secrets as pertaining to war efforts. So they thought that if the wrong person got a hold of her and she was able to deduce where the next attack was going to be, say, you know, when the British army was going to roll in and attack Germany in different areas, they thought that this could give away their war effort. So she was arrested, and she was the last person to do time in England under this. There were still some acts out there that were more for fraudulent medium acts and more along the lines of consumer protection. But as far as actual occult practices, Helen Duncan, she was the last woman ever arrested for witchcraft. And that was just in the 1940s, well over 200 years after this act had been put into place. But most of the laws, witchcraft laws around the world, came from England. You had all of these English colonies throughout the world, and including in the United States. Most of the witchcraft acts that were followed, they were British laws. You had all of these colonists coming over, and they were using English law in their courts at the time. So a lot of this flowed off of the British royalty through the crown.
And folks, again, the book out and available now, Paranormal Justice, and we're just barely touching on some of these as hot points and sprinkling in some other stories like the cases that are covered in the book. So there's a lot more information and detail with each one of these tales when you pick up a copy of the book and dive into it for yourself. I was surprised. There have been some very strange cases surrounding cryptids.
Yes.
And a gentleman by the name of Tom Biscardi has been a part of some of these cases. Mm-hmm. And I'm just curious, has anybody successfully sued hoaxers in the cryptid field, like Tom Biscardi allegedly is, for wasting people's time and money and effort in trying to fleece people, claiming that he has a cryptid or Bigfoot in his possession?
I didn't find anything about the hoaxers being sued per se, and anything along that lines. Most of what I dug up on cryptids, things like the Loch Ness Monster, there were some interesting court cases with Nessie. You actually had the Scottish Tourist Board was mm-hmm. trying to stop fish farming in the loch because it was put out there that they may harm Nessie by bringing all of this commercial work into, which they lost that case. So maybe Nessie actually has more of a diet now for fish. you look at, I believe it was somewhere around $54 million in tourism that they project Nessie brings in per year to that area of Scotland. So you're dealing with some serious tourist dollars here. The same things happen with Bigfoot cases as well. There was a senator from Oklahoma, state senator in Oklahoma, that was trying to pass a Bigfoot hunting season. He wanted to have it licensed. This went in front of the state legislature in Oklahoma. And what it boiled down to was the area he lived in had a big Bigfoot festival. It was great for tourism, and they wanted to do this. It was very tongue-in-cheek, but he wanted the Oklahoma Department of Natural Resources to actually put out a Bigfoot hunting license. They were going to have a season. It was going to be in conjunction with this big festival that they put on. So the tourist dollars definitely play into some of these, but there are legitimate acts out there as far as Bigfoot goes that, especially on the West Coast where we have a lot of sightings, there are a lot of people that are concerned that somebody is going to come out and try and kill one of these creatures. So it is protected in different areas. Now you go down to Texas, and Texas being Texas, they were asked, somebody had in a journal had asked about Bigfoot in Texas, would it be protected? They said, well, it's not on any list as being a protected species. So if it wandered out and somebody shot it, being non-human, it'd be completely legal. So depends on where you're at. Most of this comes down to state law. There's not a lot federal on the books as far as cryptids go. I did a very interesting interview with a guy named Rich Meyer. He's the head of the UP, Upper Peninsula Bigfoot Research Organization. I said, Rich, I said, do you know, any reasons why you would want or not want to have these legal protections for this creature? He said, yeah. He said, if you look at it economically, he said, look at different areas where you find an endangered creature that they didn't know was there. All of a sudden, you've got all of this land blocked off. You need to conserve the habitat. So now if you move into an area like here in the UP of Michigan, That would affect your logging industry. So by default, that would affect the paper industry. That would affect all of these different companies supplying logging, because now you need a big preserve to keep a creature of that size and a breeding population safe. So there's actually a big trickle-down effect that I hadn't thought of until I interviewed him on this. And I said, yeah, that makes complete sense. Now you're not only looking at this animal's welfare, but you could potentially cripple some large business operations and possibly knock off some different state recreation areas. It was really a fascinating talk. It brought a few things to light that I had never considered before.
You know, there are people that are born and will grow hair all over their bodies, right? There are the Wolf Boys that were part of Barnum and Bailey and many of the different freak shows through history. And it continues. There are still people that are dealing with this genetic, I don't want to call it deformity, because many of them are very happy and fine with having it. But I'm wondering what it's going to be the first time somebody does shoot one of these creatures and we find out that it is truly a human byproduct. It's either a human with a disfigurement that we're unfamiliar with, or it is one of our kind of contextual relations, you know, and how is that going to impact and affect history in total? Obviously, you know, will that person go to jail for murder, especially like in Texas? Hey, they're not on the books. They're not a protected species. They're not endangered that we're aware of. And they don't even exist really under our auspice. So by killing one, you know, and then finding out what it actually is, that's going to be an interesting dilemma.
It's the moral dilemma there, I think, more than anything. And that came up more and more as I researched into cryptids in general, but Bigfoot in specific being, you know, something that looks more like an ape, or that would be possibly a cousin to humans. And it's that moral dilemma of, do you kill it to prove that this exists? Because as we know, that's still, you know, the biggest controversy out there. Is this thing real or not?
Right.
Or do you let it go, take your blurry pictures as they tend to be, and present those and try and get the other evidence, as most Bigfoot researchers do? And, you know, it's you would absolutely hate to see one of these creatures, especially, you know, you're assuming, if they do exist, that they're in very short numbers, that to actually kill one would be a travesty. But on the devil's advocate side, how do you prove to science that these things are actually out there? You know, outside of footprint casts and the occasional hair sample that can't be identified, you know, it's that whole double-edged sword when it comes to Sasquatch.
We need to take another quick break. Our guest is Brad Blair. His book is Paranormal Justice, Hauntings, Cryptids, and Curses in the Court of Law. You can get the book on Amazon and wherever you find books. We'll be back with more right after this.
The Oregon Bigfoot Festival and Beyond is back and bigger than ever. At Oaks Amusement Park, Saturday, June 29th. Meet Bigfoot hunters like Ronnie LeBlanc of Discovery Channel's Expedition Bigfoot and Paranormal Caught on Camera. And paranormal investigators like me, Dave Schrader of the Holzer Files and the Paranormal 60 Podcast. Join us for a day of family fun celebrating Bigfoot, ghosts, UFOs, and everything beyond. You never know what you'll find. Don't miss the Oregon Bigfoot Festival and Beyond, Saturday, June 29th at Oaks Amusement Park. Get tickets today at OregonBigfootFest.com. OregonBigfootFest.com.
The Oregon Bigfoot Festival. Oregon Bigfoot Festival.
Who knows? Maybe out at the Oregon Bigfoot Festival, we'll have that discussion with Ronnie LeBlanc. What do we do? Do you, in order to make an omelet, you have to break an egg. Are we going to need to kill one of these creatures in order to protect the species by proving that they exist? It'll be an interesting situation, and we'll see how this continues to play out. But the more we encroach on wilderness and building up more and more areas, it can't be much longer before we have some kind of definitive proof one way or another.
You would think so. That's I watch very little in the way of reality television, but Expedition Bigfoot, the methods that they use and just that strict scientific approach, that show's really gotten me hooked. That's the one I will sit down and watch as new episodes come out. So, yeah, hopefully they can find it peacefully and get the protection put in place. But you know somebody's going to try and shoot one. I mean, it's
just... Well, allegedly, a few people have already shot a couple of them and have buried them and hidden the bodies. And, you know, I think that it's going to be a very strange situation if somebody ever does come forward and admits where these bodies are buried and we can prove it one way or another. But you've got too many different cultures that have talked about these beings being real to just summarily dismiss them. I can't guess that we can just go ahead and... you know, put it out that, oh, there's no possible way these beings exist when we know that there is something going on out there that, you know, we don't know everything. We're finding and uncovering new species all the time. If you want more information on the events I'll be a part of and where you can see the paranormal unfold and meet some of your favorite paranormal personalities, go check out darknessevents.com. Darknessevents.com shows all of the listing there, but make sure you come out to the miparacon.com this August. Come on out, get your tickets, get out and be a part of this conference. If you've never been to one, this is the one to get your feet wet with, because it's an amazing time and you're going to feel like you've just found the family you never knew you had. These are the family reunions I look forward to every year. Michigan Paracon, go check it out for yourself. Talking about some of the other cases and type of studies, what was one of the more surprising stories to you that you uncovered in doing the research for this book?
You know, one chapter I didn't know I was going to have enough material to put a full chapter on that ended up being maybe my favorite in the book is a chapter on the Ouija board, the board and the bench. It was so fascinating just through the history of the board going back, you know, to the Kennard Novelty Company and the Bonds. And I did a great interview with Robert Murch on that. If you're not familiar with Murch, he's the president of the Talking Board Historical Society. And we covered a lot of material. I was on for a couple of hours with Bob. And just the fascinating history and all of the legal dilemmas that went into the actual board and from a business standpoint. But then some of the other cases that started popping up, and one, it was great. I got to talk about it this weekend. I was at a writer's retreat that was mainly Hemingway themed. Ernest Hemingway's last known secretary was actually a keynote speaker at it, Valerie Hemingway.
Wow.
Amazing event. But there was a period of time in the early 1900s where there were a number of books that were professed to be written through the Ouija board by spirits. One of these, Jap Herron, that was released was credited to Mark Twain. And the legalities that ended up in this case were just wonderful. For this type of a project, it was like striking gold. Jap Herron was released 7 years after Twain's death. And Emily Hutchings, she was a medium out of the Kansas City area, said that Twain was coming through her Ouija board, dictated this entire book. And she was involved with the Society for Psychical Research. So the SPR was getting involved, and they were reaching out to Clara Clemens, Mark Twain's daughter, and said, well, this is coming through from your father. And she said, no, none of this makes sense. And it finally got to the point she felt she was being harassed. And so she just flat out told the SPR, please don't contact me again. None of this matches anything. This isn't my father coming through, if anybody's coming through. Well, Hutchings got herself a publisher, and they put the book out, Jap Herron. And Clara Clemens and the Twain estate sued. They said, this is, take my dad's name off of this, admit that it's not him, and we'll drop the case. But otherwise, we're going to court. Well, this got a lot of sensationalism in the media of the day, and Twain's old Harper and Brothers, Twain's old publishers, got involved with the case as well. And they came out and said, okay, so you're going to fight and claim that this was Mark Twain's work. We own Mark Twain's work. We own the pen name Mark Twain. Mark Twain's real name was Samuel Clemens. Harper and Brothers own the pen name Mark Twain, as well as any of his work. He was under contract for life with them. So in comes the legal dilemma of, is that contract dismissed because Twain's dead? And now what he's putting out, can that go under somebody else's name? But just using the name Mark Twain, they still owned. So there were a couple different facets. I mean, she was trying to sue to get their name off, Twain's name off of the book and off of anything represented with it. And then on the other hand, you had his publishers who were suing, saying, okay, put the book out, but you're going to have to send us all monies that you are received from it. so either you're going to come out and say you're fraudulent and you put this out claiming to be Mark Twain, but it was not, or you're going to go ahead and sell it as Mark Twain and you're going to have to send all monies received back to us, which in turn we are going to turn over to Clara and the Twain estate. So right before it went to court, they ended up settling. They put Hutchins' name on the book. It was still out there. There were copies put out with Twain's name, very few. But yeah, you had that double-edged sword then coming at them from the legal aspect, because if they would have went ahead with the lawsuit with Clara and it had passed through and the judge said, well, no, this looks like there's enough proof that this is Mark Twain coming through a Ouija board and writing this, then they would have lost any income from it anyway. So it was quite the fascinating case. And it was
a weird story, huh?
It is. And there was so much media attention around it at the time because Twain had only been dead for 7 years, one of America's top authors of all time. So people were flocking to this. Plus, you were right, in the heat of the age of spiritualism, where stories like this would get picked up left and right. Mm-hmm. So there was a lot going on for this case that people got very involved in it. And it's not the only one. Most of the others that I found, as far as books that were claimed to be written by someone deceased coming through the board, coming through a psychic, coming through automatic writing, there was no proof that the people they were coming from actually existed. So there was no worry about a lawsuit in those. For somebody to blatantly come out and say, yeah, you know, the most important author of the last half century, at least, is coming through using his name while his estate is still active, while his family is still alive. I mean, that took some cojones to even try that. And I don't, you know, especially nowadays, maybe back then we didn't have quite as many lawyers around, but to think that wouldn't end up in court somehow, it was just beyond me. But I could just picture being in a courtroom at the time when you have this argument going on and you have dual plaintiffs coming at you from two different aspects where even if you win, you lose. You know, it was just a fascinating case to research.
You know what strikes me is there's a very controversial figure in our field, and I'm not going to give his name because I know he pisses a lot of people off, that immediately upon somebody famous dying, he is releasing his spirit box transmissions. Yes. Yes. And he's been ballsy enough to do it with some of our dear friends that have passed away in the field and coming out immediately stating that he has these messages. It's in the same sense, because my understanding is a lot of the audio that he used was clips that he loads into the system of, let's say, Robin Williams, known existing clips of his voice and things that were said, and then utilizing the kind of randomization of the spirit box, he would ask questions and supposedly the spirit would take these words, piecing them together to create context. And I don't know if he was ever charging for this service or charging people to do that, but I wonder if that would open him up, much like this Mark Twain case, to a legal suit from the families, since they are using unlicensed recordings for those, sessions.
I would think once he started taking money for that, if they did, and I know exactly who you're talking about, and it usually comes out within 48 hours of somebody's death. If there's no real legal, no consideration financially, I'm not sure that you could actually establish a case there. It reminds me a little bit of, I'm sure you're familiar with it, Dave, the ghost of Flight 401. This
right.
plane that crashed in the Everglades. A book was put out on it. A made-for-TV movie came out. This was back in the 70s. Wow. Look at that.
What are the odds? I happen to have the book sitting right here at my desk. Yeah.
So Captain Bob Loft, whose ghost was reportedly seen, he perished in the plane crash in the Everglades. His ghost was reported on different aircraft that had used salvage parts from Flight 401. And one of the creepiest parts in the book, for me at least, reading it, I remember, is there was somebody in a pilot's uniform sitting in first class in a seat where no one was supposed to be. The stewardess confronted him. He didn't say a word, didn't look up. And then another member of the flight crew came out to see who it was and looked and said, "My God, it's Bob Loft." And he disappeared. And so this was, of course, a big part of the book and one of the shock scenes. Well, Loft's family came out, his widow and kids, and tried to sue. They were trying to sue the author, the publisher, and it got to the point that they were claiming invasion of privacy, which seems to me kind of where you were going with the last on this whole putting out the voice of somebody that had just died, and where is the legal issue on that? Well, when it came down to the court case, the Lofts were really hurt by this. They were pissed off. But the courts ruled that you cannot sue for invasion of somebody else's privacy, regardless of it's a family member. In this case, it was her husband. She was the widow.
Right.
But they said it has to be the person whose privacy is being invaded for a lawsuit to take any hold. So I'm almost guessing that would be the same case with this Spirit Box session.
The only thing is, though, that he's using audio clips that are licensed or that are unlicensed. He hasn't paid for those audio clips to, you know, so if he's making money off of YouTube channels and financial outlets like that, it's interesting. Not that I want to be the guy to.
There could be some copyright issues involved in that, I would think, too.
And yeah.
There were a handful of interesting cases along that lines too that did pop up on copyright infringement and different things from different paranormal cases.
So. Well, look at this new case that just came to court just a few months ago. A couple of Will Sasso and his partner for their podcast, and I can't remember the name of it off the top of my head, but they had AI created George Carlin's voice using audio dumps and remnants, and then had AI allegedly AI write jokes in the style of George Carlin. It's now recently come out that it was actually the comedians that wrote the jokes, but had the AI voice say it, and they were sued for presenting, even though it wasn't their, you know, wasn't George Carlin, it wasn't his jokes, but it was done in that style and with the voice, even though they did that disclaimer up front saying, "I am not George Carlin. George Carlin is dead. I am an AI synth voice that is reproducing a voice like this." It's going to be interesting to see how this does play out as the future unfolds. And there are many cases. Like, I know William Shatner has been scanned in, all of his audio, video, every photograph has been dumped. He wants to live forever, and he will as a hologram, an interactive being. And there are other celebrities that have allowed themselves to be tracked like this and have sold, my understanding is, sold their rights, their image rights, vocal rights, and everything so that they can continue in the future. But it'll be interesting if they start, if companies start trying to take advantage. If somebody's been dead for 100 years, are they considered, outside that realm? Can we, it's going to be an interesting.
AI is an interesting monster all in and of itself. And that came up at this writer's retreat I was at this weekend. One of the authors had been judging another short story contest. And he said something was off about one of the submissions, and it was similar to another. And they plugged it in, and they figured out that these were AI-written stories. Hmm. They ran it through. They figured, and he said it. They were good stories. They were just, something was a little off. And said once we started looking, they thought they were plagiarized. But it turned out they were AI created stories. So where you draw the line, and I mean, this is, I know, going on a discussion and legislation right now of where do we put the pin in on AI? Where do you draw the line on something like this? And yeah, like you said, when you're using a deceased person's likeness, image, you know, even a living person's, you know, some of the stuff that's out there right now on the internet that you see that people making up fake promotions using voice clips. Valerie Hemingway, she said, yeah, I did an interview and I didn't quite like part of the way it went. And they said, well, no, we can just patch everything in later. We put part of your voice into our AI simulator. So we can use your voice for anything we need to go over. She said, wait a minute. No, I'm not giving permission for that. I don't want that out there. And I don't ever want somebody having the ability to use my image, my voice for any type of a project. So, right. Yeah, it's scary. It really is. You're getting towards the Terminator days now. But no, I don't know where that's going to lead in the future. And it's another one of those things. How much do you regulate it? And where do you draw the line as far as individual rights versus, you know, somebody's right to expression using this free speech? So many different facets that could fall in on that.
It'll be interesting, too, that if there are people claiming to be in contact with a dead personality that wants to share information, where does that fall under copyright law? Where does that fall under these different elements? And yeah. You know, will there eventually have to be a court case that examines, you know, the family believes that she is definitely in contact with the ghost of Ernest Hemingway or Robin Williams or Mark Twain. And if the family gives that nod, does the court systems with the haunted house story that we talked about in the beginning, if the family acknowledges it, does that make it so in the eyes of the law? It'll be fascinating to watch how the supernatural and legal systems continue to work in concert, you know, with one another. I know the famous case that was covered in the final Conjuring movie that came out talking about the devil made me do it. Right. You know, they brought it to court and boom, it was thrown out immediately. That whole concept of this is baloney, you know, so let me just address that up front. And he threw that case out. Which really kind of crippled Ed and Lorraine Warren and, mm-hmm. you know, really hurt them because they wanted to finally be able to show people what, you know, what they believe was true paranormal, supernatural, and demonic energy that had manifested.
Well, and that attorney was basing that. I do have a segment on that. There's a chapter on possession in the law. He'd base that off of a couple of English cases, British cases, where the people went free. Because they went off of a possession defense and the courts over there, I heard it out and yeah, we seem to have enough evidence. So yeah, he was that kind of stymied the whole Arnie Johnson defense when the judge threw that out. He said, we're not setting up a media circus here.
Exactly. Brad Blair, our guest, the book again is called Paranormal Justice, Hauntings, Cryptids, and Curses in the Court of Law. The book is out and available now, and it's available in physical form. Is it available as ebook, audiobook? Where else can people find that, the different varieties?
It's currently out in a Kindle version and paperback on Amazon. I don't even have my own copies of it yet. I'm waiting for those supposedly this week. But yeah, right now that's the place to get them. They will be in select booksellers within the next couple of weeks. But yeah, right now, Amazon's a place to go for it.
Perfect. Get a copy of the book, and then once you've got the book, remember to rate and review it. Brad, I will be seeing you later, and you and I have some fun stuff that we are in the midst of working on. We'll be making announcements on later this year as well, but I look forward to seeing you at the Michigan Paracon and beyond. So thank you, my friend.
Thank you, Dave.
Always a pleasure. Well, something to give you pause, something to make you sit back and look, and maybe even find a way to teach your children about history, taking them back and showing them really compelling elements of our history, from vampire and werewolf trials to witchcraft and magic to Ouija boards and more. It's an amazing way to capture history in an imaginative way and make it accessible to so many more. Make sure to get a copy of the book for yourself, but research, go out and see these things, experience them. It's unbelievable the amount of amazing stories that exist out there and as part of our world. And I hope that the darkness of this world is just a little brighter with the information and the light that we shine here on the Paranormal 60. And thank you so much for taking me along on your journey. It is definitely an honor to be a part of your journey. And I hope to see you again here when we return on Wednesday for the Paranormal 60 News. Until then, I'm Dave Schrader, and this is the best in paranormal programming. This is my Paranormal 60.